This is the Edisto TV podcast, connecting the Blackwater region.
This is the Edisto TV podcast. I'm Hugo.
And I'm Tom.
And this is episode 7. This week we are going to start by concluding our interview with Bob Guild that we started last week. If you missed the beginning of that interview, you can go back and find episode 6 of the Edisto TV podcast and download that and listen to part 1. Bob is a prominent South Carolina environmental lawyer, good friend of Friends of the Edisto, and lives over on the North Fork, downstream of me. And what did you think of what Bob had to say last week, Tom?
I like what Bob has to say. I think it's really important as we prepare for the next legislative session. Those of us who have concerns about the laws regarding surface water removal, we need to think about what it is that we want the law to change to. And so we need to start to formulate that so that we can give that to lobbyists, concerned legislators, et cetera. So I think Bob has a really good first pass at what needs to change in the law. So I just want everybody to kind of get a hold of that, and let's start to formulate that.
All right. Well, with that, let's pick up with the interview with Bob Guild, and then we'll come back with a little discussion of some of our activities on the river in the past few days and how that ties into some river history, and we'll have all that and more. But first, we're going to break for this.
This is Tom from the Edisto TV podcast, and I just want to put in a word for Tyler Brothers. They've been serving the Blackwater region for over 100 years. They have lawn and garden center with plenty of steel and Husky chainsaws, weed trimmers, blowers, plenty of Husqvarna mowers, and if you've got a lot of grass to cut, check out those Husqvarna zero-turn mowers. They have 3 or 4 different models to choose from. Check them out at tylerbrothers.net, or if you're on Facebook, you definitely want to follow them and get the latest deals from them. You can find them at facebook.com/tylerbros or search for Tyler Brothers, and you'll find Tyler Brothers for Carhartt clothing. They are the place for guns and ammo, your Carhartt work clothes. They've got camo from Carhartt and Drake and many more. Work boots from Georgia Boot, Rocky, Red Wing, Justin, Wolverine, and many more. They are the place for your safety shoes, your snake boots, your camo, whatever else you need when you are out in the swamp. Tyler Brothers, since 1904, is the place for you to be on a Saturday afternoon. They're open 8 to 6, 6 days a week. Closed on Sunday. Stay away from the superstores and visit Tyler Brothers in Wagner.
And we're back with the Edisto TV podcast, episode 7. Let's jump right into that interview with Bob Guild.
Do you think we have to do all these studies before we change the law? I mean, that sounds like a lot of expense and a lot of time. Is there anything in the law that could change just at least to prevent the, you know, the idea of pulling 2/3 of the water out of the river, one farmer?
Yeah, absolutely. No, you put your finger right on it. I mean, no, the need for study and research should not be an excuse for inaction. And if I suggested otherwise, no, don't mistake me at all. And I think you're going to hear a lot of people saying, oh, we need more study, we need more data, and we need to, you know, delay fixing the problem until we have no, not at all. I'm not saying that at all. Because in effect, if you just basically extend the same requirements that are in the law right now for industry and all other withdrawers to what they define as agricultural use, and keep in mind, agricultural use is a term in the law that, you know, you and I may think we know what it is, but believe me, it covers a lot of ground. Growing trees is agricultural use. Raising confined poultry and hogs is agricultural use. You know, having a family garden is agricultural use. You know, the definition of what's agricultural use under our surface water law is as broad as it could possibly be and covers a variety of non-traditional kinds of agriculture, I might say. Point really is that if you require the same permitting process for all users of large amounts of water withdrawal from the rivers, and the trigger in the law is 3 million gallons a month. So, you know, less than that, you know, there's no requirement for any registration or permitting. But instead of just having a registration, if you require a permit for all users, you'd at least provide the opportunity for a couple of things. First, there'd be public notice and an opportunity for the public to participate. That means other river users, members of Friends of the Edisto who use the river for recreational purposes, members of Friends of the Edisto and others who are riparian landowners who care about the ecological health of the river, FRED members and others who are agricultural users themselves but who haven't yet made their claim on the river and want to protect their future access to river water, and all other users of the river too, up to and including folks like SCEG that have a major a power plant on the system that needs to protect its water withdrawal rights. Anyway, all those said, if you'd have to have public notice, and any of those interests could participate in the permitting process. And then you essentially require at least some assessment of whether the registration, or in this case, the permitted withdrawal, Walther or another large agricultural user down the road, would have to demonstrate that basically the amount they proposed to withdraw met a test of reasonableness, which includes consideration of a variety of factors that are not only the needs of other users, but they're the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of the river. That is the ecological effects of their withdrawal. And that's where science can come to play, and that's where, you may not have the research done before you change the law, but if there's another major withdrawal proposed and it's subject to permitting, the science would be brought to bear at that point, and that would be the key. If we had the Walther proposal in front of us under a permitted system at the beginning of this process, instead of having to play catch up the way we've had, there would have been a scientific discussion at the beginning of the process of whether the Walther withdrawal met that test, whether it was reasonable in the context of the law. And that would have included ensuring that withdrawal at low flow times, when the river is most vulnerable, had curtailment requirements, because curtailment requirements are included for users other than agricultural users. So the bottom line is there are reforms that are available today, well before we have complete understanding of the science of what the needs of our rivers are, and those measures are what were proposed in the laws and in the bills that were introduced this last session, late in the session, but will be, I'm sure, reconsidered come January when the new legislative session begins. And those include the legislation that was the stopgap. That's the moratorium bill that was proposed that would basically say, wait, and take a deep breath, stop, no more withdrawals under this registration system, unless you want to go and seek a permit under the terms that are available to all other users. And then the more permanent fix, which is to basically eliminate the agricultural exemption and say that all large withdrawals have to go through that permitting process. So those are the two measures that were on the table when the legislature left town in June. And because it was a two-year session, bills that were introduced late in the second year really aren't likely to get any hearing unless they're so non-controversial that everybody votes for them. In this case, this whole subject, of course, is extraordinarily controversial. And we'll have to start in January, with those bills or others that try to fix the problem.
So, Bob, does that mean that any farmer who wants 3 million gallons a month or more is basically going to have a fight on their hands? Somebody's going to be trying to say that they shouldn't take that water? I'm trying to think about the burden that's just going to put on farmers and how the farmer community, Farm Bureau, and the Department of Agriculture, how do they respond to this idea that every $3 million gallon withdrawal requires, a full permitting process?
Well, I mean, there's no magic about that 3 million gallon trigger, and we've seen in our records of what registrations there have been on the Edisto system that, lots of them cluster around the, 5 or 10 million gallon per month withdrawal. And, the Walther certainly is an outlier. When you're basically, these are not numbers that are in front of me right now, so I'm just basically recalling, but I think prior to Walther, the largest withdrawer had maybe a dozen intake points. So there were separate withdrawals in the system somewhere, you know, up and down that system, but, you know, one large agricultural entity. And their total withdrawal was still, I want to say, two-thirds of what the withdrawal with the Walters proposed. So the bottom line is most of the withdrawers are small, and small by comparison to Walther. But there are a number that exceed, you know, a large dairy farm might exceed the 3 million gallons per month. In any event, point being, you know, you could set the trigger at a variety of levels. 3 million gallons is what the law sets it at. But I think if you're talking about small withdrawals, they're not going to be controversial at all. We've seen two registrations since Walther, at least two that DHEC has told us about. And they were in that same ballpark, I want to say, you know, 10 or so that were in magnitude million gallons a month. And I think seen as, you know, just non-controversial, as far as I know, there was no, you know, adverse response when those withdrawals were published. But I do think that the permitting process is one that that provides the public an opportunity to participate if there are significant impacts. And, you know, you really can't say that all impacts of a certain size are insignificant, depending on the stream involved. I mean, if you could have a small tributary where you're proposing, on the face of it, looks like a modest water withdrawal, but it's a withdrawal that essentially takes all the water out of that tributary. So, you know, the number of gallons per month, the 3 million gallons is an arbitrary value. 3 million gallons is insignificant from, you know, a number of major river systems, but I venture to say is all the water there would be in you know, in some tributary stream. So bottom line is there's no better way of doing this that I know of that to say that you have a permitting process with some objective standards. And for most permits, you know, they're non-controversial, and the DHEC staff guy makes the calculation, and there's a public notice, and nobody raises a question, and the permit's granted. I mean, the number of cases that DHEC sees that get appealed are a pretty good indication, generally, of how few. Notice the DHEC board had one. The number one had only one dispute that was brought to their attention last month, out of thousands and thousands of permits that I'm confident, you know, crossed their desk and were issued. So, you know, that's just the nature of our due process system: is notice and an opportunity to be heard before the government harms your interest. And that, when I say your interest, I mean you guys who own land on the river, who use the river, who have a riparian interest in your rights to water withdrawal on the river. You know, you and we are the folks that are entitled to public notice if a water withdrawal authorization or permit affects our interest. And that doesn't mean we have to do anything about it. We're just entitled to know about it and to comment or be heard, you know, if our interests are going to be harmed before the agency makes a decision. And of course, that's what didn't happen in the Walther cases. We learned about the withdrawal only by happenstance. And you guys have recounted that story. I think it's always interesting to think about how, you know, you only learn about that monster intake structure on the South Fork of the Edisto because by happenstance, you know, one of our colleagues is called to the site and sees the work in progress. But it's in the middle of nowhere, literally. We love that fact that it's in the middle of nowhere. But no one would have seen it until, you know, either, you know, it was up and running and the fisher person happened to go past it, past the intake, or worst case, you noticed the harmful effects to the river after the damage was done. So notice is a real key thing that I think is part of our system and not objectionable in most other contexts. So that's what I think is called for, and that's what the Surface Water Act requires of all other withdrawers. You know, there's no reason, in my opinion, why agriculture ought to be given a complete pass, which the law does. I mean, we understand the politics of it, and politics of it, as I'm told, was at the time the law was being discussed, agriculture made clear that they would use all their clout to block any surface water withdrawal law being passed unless they were given this free ride. And I think that free ride is a consequence of them throwing their weight around at the time, and I'm talking about the Farm Bureau, and I think they're throwing their weight around since, because they got the free ride and they want to protect it. That's no surprise to anybody, but I think it's irrational, and I think the experience we've had with the Walder Farm that's given us the wake-up call reinforces the point that there's no rational basis for treating a utility one way and a large agricultural farm, an industrial agricultural operation, another. And given the industrial agriculture withdrawal, essentially preferential treatment by not requiring them to demonstrate that their withdrawal protects other users and the ecology of the river.
For more information and archived podcasts, visit us at edisto.tv.
So do you think that farmers, we know where Farm Bureau stands, but I feel like part of our challenge is to try to change change the mind of farmers, or at least educate them to where they could tell Farm Bureau that this is acceptable. I mean, do you think farmers are going to be okay saying, yeah, go ahead and give me a permitting process where previously I could do it with just a simple registration? I'm trying to make – I think Farm Bureau may in the end listen to its members, but and I think most members are reasonable. But how do you think the farmers will respond to this kind of approach?
Well, I think we've seen, a pretty good indication that the Farm Bureau doesn't speak for all farmers, and that their reaction to the very modest proposals to reform this law were extreme and unhelpful and downright rude. I mean, it doesn't take you or me or an environmentalist to say so. When they accused all of the proponents of protecting the river of being radical environmentalists who wanted to destroy the family farm, and if that is an exact quote, it's a pretty fair paraphrase of overheated rhetoric that the Farm Bureau spewed on the web and everywhere else they could be heard on this subject. It didn't take us to defend ourselves. A member of the state Senate took the floor and said, what's radical here is essentially raping our river by allowing unrestricted withdrawals. And what's radical here is not applying a rational, fair system to ensure that all users are protected. Consider this. The farmers who live on the Edisto system, who don't yet have a registered right to withdraw water from the river in perpetuity. By definition, the way the law works right now is once they file their registration, it's their property right forever. I mean, in perpetuity. That's the way the law is currently designed. So Walder has a perpetual right to withdraw the maximum amount of water per year forever. Well, picture yourself being a riparian agricultural landowner on the Edisto system downstream, and you have it nailed down, your perpetual water withdrawal right, but your competitor upstream got a lawyer or the Farm Bureau or whoever else to get them, in the front of the line to nail down their withdrawal right. And you're left out in the cold because essentially the river's water is over allocated. And that's our concern, is that the river the law sets up a system where the river's water will be over allocated if you simply follow the measures of the law, and it will not protect the ecological functions of the river, because remember, the whole problem with the way the law is written is it's based on mean daily or average daily flows in the river, not those low flows. You know, the river's never at average level. It's always either very high or very low, but average is just the mathematical calculation of the difference between the two. And as a consequence, over-allocation will mean that the low flow conditions won't be taken into account, and the river will be sucked dry or too dry. But the other consequence is, if you're that agricultural landowner downstream and they've over-allocated the river water already, you're left holding the bag. You are unprotected by the way this system works. So there are farm interests, agricultural interests, that I would say first have been maligned and mischaracterized because they care about the river too. I mean, they're our friends who both are farmers but who also hunt and fish the Edisto system and use the system for recreational purposes. Love to see the river maintained as a healthy system. They also happen to be potential future users of the withdrawal rights themselves, and those rights to future withdrawal are not protected. So there are a number of folks who basically say, wait a minute, this law essentially takes the property of those riparian landowners, including farmers, who have yet to nail down their riparian rights to water withdrawal. It's the state taking your water rights, which are common law rights protected under our state constitution and under long hundreds of years of common law. Those rights to water use from the river that you own the bank of are taken away without any compensation or due process under the current Surface Water Act. So I would say that there are farmers who have a strong interest in protecting the surface water availability and reforming the surface water law, as do any other people who care about the river. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not these extremely corrosive and destructive politics of name-calling that the Farm Bureau is engaged in, you know, will successfully in the long run serve the interests of farmers or anyone else. I know that in the first salvo, as I said, you know, within days of the accusations of radical environmentalists trying to destroy family farms was leveled by the Farm Bureau. We saw, you know, conservative members of the state Senate, hunter-fishermen, advocates, you know, elected representatives of the people, take to the floor of the state Senate and express their, you know, extreme reaction to being in that category of name-calling, on the receiving end of that name-calling from the Farm Bureau. So in some ways, engaging in those kind of tactics have already backfired on them, and I hope they're hearing from their members who say, listen, I'm one of those radical environmentalists. I hunt and fish the Edisto, and you're not speaking for me when you say we shouldn't protect our river.
So that is segment two of the Bob Gild interview, and Tom, like you were saying, I mean, when it comes to people who have a really coherent voice and a vision of where we need to be headed with some of the surface water access issues that we're dealing with, I think Bob is a great place to start. What do you think?
Yes, very good place to start. And also, it reminds me how, you know, the people had very good intentions when they created this law. But I think, as you have said, you know, the law isn't doing what it was intended to do, which is to protect the rivers. And so it's going to have to change. And hopefully we're going to have a clear picture of how to change it in the next year.
Yeah, I do know that there is some stuff taking place behind the scenes. And hopefully here through the summer, we'll have a chance to talk about some of the progress, positive progress that we see being made on that front.
Yeah, it's politics, and you know we're getting a little view at how that works, but it takes all kinds of people at every level, And I'm thankful that we have a voice as individuals who care about the river.
All right. So this is the Edisto TV podcast, and we'll be back with more in just a moment.
For more information and archived podcasts, visit us at edisto.tv.
Back on the Edisto TV podcast, and this past week on Thursday, Tom and I and our good friend Scott Broom went out in search of the remains of the Swamp Rabbit's Trestle across the North Fork. You'll find it on the map just west of Fairview Crossroad. And you might remember a couple of episodes ago, we did talk about the Swamp Rabbit Railroad on one of our history segments. And Tom, having paddled, climbed, and trudged down the stretch of river from my place to the next bridge downstream, what are your impressions of the North Fork? That was your first time on my piece of the river, right?
It was really, really shallow. I was amazed at how low the water was in so many places. And what was neat was Scott brought along his GPS, and you know, there's a thing where you can look at the elevation changes, and it, you don't expect elevation changes on a river, but a lot of times we would climb up 6 or 8 feet and then down 6 or 8 feet. There was a lot of climbing over logs, and I'm in the process of posting a blog post that has some pictures and also a photo album on Edisto TV, but it was probably more climbing than paddling. I mean, very, very little actual paddling.
Yeah, after the fact, I was telling a friend of mine about it, and I told him it was as if we looked at the river and said, you know, I'm going to climb that tree, but first I'm going to go get my boat.
Yeah, get my boat, and then I'll climb the tree with my boat in hand. So that's a fun way to go.
Yeah, well, Tom is going to have some pictures to put up. I think we'll probably post some of the GPS information that Scott recorded just for general entertainment value. And I'll also post some stuff. I've got some decent video of the trestle site and also one of our little no-legged friends that we saw on the river during that paddle.
But also one of the most exciting parts of this was we found our listener. Yeah,
that is true. Scott Broom is one of our biggest fans, it turns out.
Yeah, so that was kind of exciting when I asked him if he had, you know, heard the podcast or anything. He said, oh, yeah. He said, I just downloaded episode 6 and partway through listening to it. So those of you who are downloading, I know we've had a bunch of downloads, and I know people are listening, so we do appreciate it. And we're going to try to have a mechanism for you all to give us some feedback. In the meantime, edisto.tv/contact, you can, you know, go to the contact form, send us a note, tell us if you want us to talk about something, if you have input, if we say something wrong and you want to correct us, we always love those. You know, communicate with us.
Yes, by all means, if Tom says something wrong, please email us and correct him. Also, I do want to mention Scott Broom is going to join us on the podcast. We weren't able to hook up a phone call for this week's podcast, but next week we're going to have him on. We're going to get him to talk a little bit about what it's like paddling these blackwater, flatwater streams like the North Fork and the South Fork. And he has a little classification system been working on describing the various obstacles that might be encountered on the water. And also, I think that Scott's agreed to talk a little bit about how he does a lot of his podcast listening and maybe throw out some ideas on how folks out there can access the Edisto TV podcast in ways they might not have thought of.
Yeah, one thing that's always interesting to me is, you know, if somebody says they do listen to podcasts, like, how do you listen to it? You know, I have my way. I've got my Android phone. I have an app called Pod Trapper. And, you know, it works like a charm. I have about 6 or 8 podcasts that, you know, download pretty much regularly. And, but yet Scott uses a totally different way. A lot of people use various tools. There's tons of ways of doing a podcast or listening to a podcast.
I just wait till you send me the link.
Yeah.
So that's what's up with our search for the Swamp Rabbit. We did find the trestle site. And as I say, we'll get some media up of that, and next week we'll talk some more with Scott Broom about what it was like paddling down there.
Well, yeah, and the thing about the trestle site that I found was, you know, just kind of interesting is just, I guess, the history of it. Just standing there and thinking about a big old locomotive, you know, cruising through that swamp, you know, probably, what, 100 years ago or more?
More than 100 years ago it started, and I believe that the swamp rabbit went away in the 20s.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's pretty neat because it is really a desolate area now. I mean, there's just not a lot there, but the fact that...
Once upon a time, a throbbing artery of commerce ran right through that spot.
Yeah, it's amazing.
All right, so we'll look forward to that for next week. Also, next week we are going to have a history segment with Vince Furtick about the Stock Haven site over on the South Fork. He's got some family history there. They were there when Sherman came through, and he's going to talk about how Stock Haven got its name.
Yeah, well, also... hopefully over the next few weeks we'll talk about some of these things you were reading earlier, some of these journals and things from the Civil War of people crossing the Edisto, and you know what they met with on the other side, and people, you know, struggling, those troops, Sherman's troops especially, you know, trying to get through the swamps.
Well, and when you think that they were coming through in January, February of 1865, it was freezing cold, it was flooded. The roads were being destroyed and the bridges were being burnt and rebuilt and circumnavigated, and it was tough times in the swamp back then.
Yeah, that would have been something.
All right, so that's where we are at. I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Edisto TV Podcast. This has been Episode 7. Tom, say goodnight.
Good night.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week.
This is the Edisto TV Podcast, produced by Edisto TV, connecting the Blackwater region.